Alright, so I'm going to go ahead and start. I owe you a few things. It's been sort of a tough week research-wise for putting out my paper, so I have deadlines on the sort of meeting this week on that, but I think I owe you rankings, and I think the last reading assignment summaries, etc., so I'll try to do that. I will also try to set deadlines for the next set of things so that you actually have a little time to recover once you're back from spring break doing whatever you're doing. I want space for 6/1/13, I think, the exam Tuesday after spring break. I figured that was my mean quota for my career. They hated me for that. That was tough on them. At any rate, so I'll try to factor that in. So we're starting to get into some really fun stuff,
I don't know, I won't bother prefacing it. We started talking about some fun stuff last time, and let's continue that.
So just to remind you briefly, quantum mechanics really arises from the fact that nature doesn't seem to see a fundamental separation between waves and particles the way we do conceptually, and the way in which we did mathematically and modeling up until sort of that time. And so quantum mechanics proper really had to be developed in the 1920s and early 1930s to deal with the fact that the mechanics of particles had to do with the fact that particles were waves, at least particularly on small scales, because I think you've even done some examples. When you go to macroscopic objects, the wavelength is so small that these kinds of quantum effects aren't important. So Schrodinger came up with this wave equation, and this wave equation, I mean, it's not crazy to look at it and think of the wave function, the psi, as being some sort of symbol for what the wave is doing in much the same way that we have a classical, when you classically solve waves, I don't know that we looked at the equation, but you end up with something which is a spatial piece and a time piece. This happens to be only a spatial part for Schrodinger equation. But you have a spatial piece and a time piece, and you basically have a wave function. And so you sort of think of the wave function in that case to be a function of sine or cosine. And we've seen a little bit of that. So naively, this classically doesn't seem, I mean, naively, this doesn't seem so different from the idea of what had been developed classically. But there are some differences, and it turns out that one of the major differences is that mathematically, the wave function psi, in this case, is a mathematically complex function that contains I, which is the square root of minus 1. And the minute you throw that into something, your actual interpretation of what that is in the real world doesn't really make sense, because we know what a cosine is, but what's an I cosine or something like that? So it's complicated, but it turns out that when you square psi, it's very well defined. It's a real number, a real function, something you can interpret. And so Max Born interpreted psi as where really you may do the calculation in psi, but in the end you can only physically interpret psi square, which turns out to be a probability density. So if I have some solution for psi in space, if I take the square of psi and I multiply it by, say, a volume in space, then that represents the probability of that particle being in that volume. So it is literally a probability density. So whatever it is that you're talking about quantum mechanically, you have only a connection to the real world and an interpretation of psi squared, and that interpretation is probabilistic, which is very different from what we've seen in Newtonian physics. And it turns out to sort of wreak havoc on us in some ways, because it makes quantum mechanics very different
from what we've seen before. So we talked a little bit last time about how if we took a particle, could be an electron or a photon, put it through a thin slit, we know since it has wave properties, it has to diffract. If it diffracts, then what that means is that if I had a whole beam of these things, I would end up with a distribution of them, if I had a detector here, that is spread out. It wouldn't look just like the shadow of this. It would sort of spread out. And so I would end up with some sort of wide distribution like that, which is known as diffraction. It's a classical wave effect. Since psi in the quantum mechanical description of this particle represents, since psi squared represents probability, then basically when I try to describe this particle as it propagates through this slit all the way to this detector, psi squared, which is the probability distribution, has to contain within it the ability or this distribution that's very wide because of diffraction. And in fact, if I send one of these particles through, all I know is that it interacts at some specific point. And if I send another one through, it'll interact at some other specific point. And as I do thousands of them, I will end up with a distribution that would look like this, where what I'm trying to say is that this orange describes how many of these things interact at a certain point in here. So most of them interact at right around here because this is peaking here. I hope that's conceptual. What I'm trying to do. This direction in the orange basically is a measure of an intensity of electrons on that surface if you do a lot. So what that means is that if we describe mathematically this electron using quantum mechanics, psi has to have within it the ability for the electron to basically be anywhere on this detector. So psi squared has to be, basically will be that probability distribution right up until the very instant that the particle interacts with the detector. The moment it interacts with the detector, the wave-like nature of it basically goes away, and it's the particle nature that becomes important, which is why we think of electrons as particles. So it interacts with a particular piece of the detector, and when that happens, we get a signal there, and we know where it is. There's no uncertainty about where it is. We know exactly where it is. So in that very instant, the mathematical description of it, the psi function, has to collapse from this sort of thing that's very fuzzy to this thing that is very, very sharp. And within that picture, it happens instantaneously. So we say that we have wave function collapse. And if you think of psi as some sort of real thing, then it really should bother you, because what you have is something that is large and finite in extent that collapses to something that is infinitely sharp instantaneously, which violates everything else we know. So this kind of picture of a wave function collapse is basically accepted in quantum mechanical calculations. Conceptually, if you sort of think of this wave function as collapsing, it's called the Copenhagen interpretation. It all happens in our universe, and why you don't get bothered by it is that you can never see psi. All you see are probability distributions. So you don't really observe this wave function collapsing. So it's a little bit slipped under the rug, and it has bothered people, including very well-known people like Einstein and such. There have been deep conversations about this that continue to today. I don't know how many of them. I'm sure that you've got to be arguing about this somewhere in the philosophy department and occasionally in quantum mechanics classes here. But this is certainly something people still argue about. What people don't argue about is the fact that quantum mechanical calculations work. When you pull out psi square,
you get it. It really works. You are able to calculate things.
And so quantum mechanics somehow is describing reality, and we sort of have to accept that and try to figure out what that means and where to go with it. And I think I mentioned last time something called the Einstein-Podolsky-Rolle paradox. So in 1935, they constructed sort of this thought experiment, which is really more than a thought experiment because you can go in the lab and actually do this. And you can create effectively a quantum state of multiple particles that gets spread over both time and space at some level. And we call those entangled particles. And the particular example in this case regards a particle that decays into two photons. And photons have a characteristic that is measurable, known as spin. And the spin will have an orientation where it's either going pointed in the direction of the photon or against the direction of the photon's propagation. And you know exactly what the spin is. I mean, we've talked a little bit about it. It's not really so important. Just think of it as having a characteristic that has some directionality. And it is part of the quantum wave function. It is a characteristic of these photons. So, and it is tied up with things like momentum conservation in an angular sense. So this isn't completely out of the blue. People do go in the lab and measure spins of particles and measure the fact that the total spin in the system is conserved and things like that. So it was known that there are particles where you could decay into two photons where the spins are oriented like this or they're oriented like this. So they're either, as the photons are going away, they're oriented like this or they're oriented like that. And those are your only two choices, and you have a 50-50 probability of it being one way or the other. And so then the idea is that that 50-50 probability, I mean, you really do not know what it is until you actually make an observation. And when you make the observation, again, this 50-50 probability function has to collapse into one way or the other way. And that probability has to be preserved until that point. So that's how quantum mechanics handles it. But then it leads to this crazy situation where you have this entangled state that could spread over a great distance. And you then make a measurement of one of the photons over here. And the very instant you do that, this one has to be determined in its orientation. Even though this could be a great distance. So, you know, does this really mean that the information travels greater than the speed of light? So it's a very bothersome thing. And again, Copenhagen has sort of said, well, we talk about this psi and the fact that you have these things preserved, but at some level, all you see is this observation. So they would argue that you're not really violating causality because all you're seeing is spin one way or the other, but somehow you're not observing the fact that this wave function psi somehow maintains this fuzzy probability until the very instant that they're detected. Yeah.
I see why the instantaneous transmission of information is really mind-boggling and frustrating, but why is the previous case you're talking about so frustrating to think about with just a single collapse of psi? Why is that such a...
This one?
Yeah.
Well, it's sort of the same picture. What you'll see are some thought examples that are all saying the same thing, but they get increasingly ridiculous today. So in this one, it may not seem to bother you so much, but this could be an actual, you know, this could be inches. So it's really no different from the other one. Whether I have instantaneous collapse and the information is conveyed instantaneously over an inch, or whether it's over 10,000 kilometers, it's a question of degree. The fact that I have this instantaneous collapse. So this really is sort of the same example, except the other example is a bit more extreme.
I could have...
Just 1 second, let me finish the thought. It also introduces something which is known as entangled particles, where you quite literally have particles that
that are correlated in terms of their characteristics. And quantum mechanics allows them to say be one way or another way or another way, but you can't have this one be over here and that one over there. They are correlated in how they are. And that kind of thing is known as an entangled wave function, entangled quantum state. And the reason I'm sort of bringing that up right now is relevant for this one example, but it also turns out to be a really hot area. If you've ever heard of something called quantum computing, that turns out to be something where they literally are taking finite distributions of particles and they're putting them in an entangled quantum state and then somehow using that to make calculations. It's very weird stuff, and I don't even pretend to understand it. There are people in the part of the community that I'm not one of. So anyway, entangled states you'll hear more and more about. But anyway, go ahead and
just to say, I couldn't really think of a great real-world example of when other probabilities collapse. Like, when you roll dice, the probability of being one other than collapses certain things, right?
Yeah, and in fact, this afternoon, you guys are going to be using that as a quantum example. You're going to be, yeah, so...
Which doesn't seem very frustrating.
Well, okay, that you could literally slow that down on video and look at the mechanics and see that it actually happened over a finite time. I mean, that you could sort of do. Whereas this, up until the very moment that the wave interacts, you have to allow it to have all the possibilities. Because you truly, within this conceptual picture of quantum, or within the actual math calculation, you truly have no idea where it's going to go. It's not like when it's a millimeter from here, you see it converging on that spot. The only information you have is the probability distribution until the moment it interacts, and then all that happens to the probability distribution completely changes. So that's why it's so different. And this other example is important because it makes that thing, it's a different example, but it sort of takes the same basic effect and makes it sound completely ridiculous because these photons can propagate very, very far away. So it is very bothersome.
So what does this mean? Well, let me actually. I want to look at another example while we're doing it. So, another thing that people often use to illustrate this kind of situation would be where you have what's called a double slit, and in a double slit experiment, you can imagine having a wave. Oops. Let's do it this way. You have some sort of wave incident on the double slit, and then that wave comes through each of the two slits, and you can imagine that you could have slit one and slit two, and you can imagine each of the slits is basically acting as a new source of the wave, because as the wave hits it, it'll basically diffract out of each of them. And if the wave goes at a certain speed on this other side, if this distance and that distance differ by an integral number of wavelengths, or if I wanted to imagine that that I drew them so that they go the same distances exactly, so they meet right here, then the two waves would interfere constructively and you would get basically them to add together. So if you did this with light, what you would find is that you would get a bright bit right here. If these two paths differ by a half a wavelength, then when one gets there with a trough, the other will have a peak and they'll cancel out. So you'll get a dark fringe. And this is known as a double slit pattern. So what will happen with this is that if we put, if it's light and we put film here, you would get sort of an intensity pattern that would look like bright fringes on the film.
I'm sending it to, through two fringes, and then I use the lens to sort of make it big. And what you see, though, I send it through two slits. You can see this sort of this pattern of these fringes. Okay. If I don't send it through the lens, I don't know if you can see it well, but you basically just have the same pattern. All right. So that's known as the classic double slit interference. And it's another example of this kind of thing that
people talk about. So you can imagine that I have some sort of a laser or light. I create, the light comes out, I send it through, or could think of it as electrons either way. I send it then through a double slit, and when I do that, what I find, if I have a detector on this other side, I'll get an intensity pattern that looks something like this. Where this direction is a measure of the intensity of the light, or the intensity of the electron signal. All right. So if we were to look, make it film and just look at it, we would end up staring at a pattern that would look sort of like these bright fringes that you just saw. Okay, so that's sort of the idea. Now this will work with any kind of wave, so you can imagine that I take a single electron or a single photon and I send it through this double slit pattern. And if I have just the one, if I were to cover one of these slits up, okay, then I send it. If I sent thousands of them, I would end up with an intensity distribution that would look like that. It would look like the single slit diffraction pattern, okay? If I took it and I covered the other slit up, then I would get the single slit diffraction pattern, but it would be centered at the other slit. Okay? If I opened up both of them, then I'll get the intensity pattern we just talked about, the sort of double slit thing. Because basically what happens
is that this particle, as it goes, if you think of it as a particle, it makes complete nonsense that it goes through both splits at the same time. But it's a wave. Because it's a wave, it acts just like the light waves we just saw. It effectively goes through both of these slits and interferes with itself and creates this interference pattern. So if you have thousands of them, you say, maybe they're interfering with themselves or whatever, but you can do this one electron at a time. And when you do it one electron at a time, when you send the first one through, you'll get one detection, like here, 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 whatever, okay? You don't see the pattern because you haven't done it. But if you do thousands of them, even if you do them one at a time separated by 5 days each, okay? You do thousands of them, you'll end up with an intensity pattern that will exhibit this double slit interference. So what that means is that each particle that goes through the double slits has this probability distribution basically encoded into its side. And then when it interacts, it collapses to wherever it was. But they all have that full information. And in the end, what quantum mechanics tells us is that when we look at many of them, we get the proper probability distribution, where they basically are waves that interfere with themselves and give you this double slit thing. Even though when you demand that they collapse from a wave to a particle, that somehow you're only getting a piece of it. So it's sort of weird. Okay, so single electrons coming individually, they go through, they interfere with themselves individually, and they end up giving you basically this full pattern of intensity that we've seen. If I cover this slit up, the electron goes through, it now only goes through this single slit, and I get this distribution, okay? Now, it turns out, you can put a detector behind one of the slits that does not destroy the electron. So you can think of it as just a little piece of metal. As the electron goes through the slit, it causes a slight fluctuation in the charge distribution in that piece of metal by something we call induction, and you get a little signal. So you can actually tell which slit the electron particle goes through. If you do this, this pattern collapses into this pattern, which effectively is as if the electrons now select one or the other, and they give you the two slit, as if you were going through each slit individually, you get the diffraction pattern for each slit individually. In other words, when you put a detector that even doesn't destroy the electron behind one of these slits so that you can determine via the information which slit it went through, you break the two-slit interference pattern, and you basically are forcing the electron to act as if it goes through one slit or the other. If you take that detector away, that pattern comes back. I'm not covering a slit. Yeah. You get this.
So this kind of thing has caused all sorts of strange thoughts, to say the least. I don't know, have you read anything about this kind of stuff?
What have you read? What have you picked up?
I was reading like all about Bell's theorem on like Wikipedia, so it's really affecting like his inequalities. And sort of the scope I was looking at it from was like my friend is like very deterministic, so I was like sort of like looking at it from like a manner of like trying to argue with him. But he like, so I was also reading about like pure determinism and what So like, so essentially, like, I've looked at all the waves, and I'm like, when you put the detector there, it breaks down to a particle. But like, what my friend would say in that situation is that, you were going to put the detector there, so therefore it was going to break down into a particle and that sort of thing. That was more like the way I was like doing it. So I was trying to argue with it.
Yeah, well, you'll see a lot of fun stuff out there. What I think is happening is that you talked about a non-destructive detector. And what is true is you can put a detector there that can tell you which slit the electron goes through without destroying the electron. That is certain. But it doesn't mean that the detector has not interacted somehow with that electron. I mean, you do have to perturb the detector with the electric field of the electron, and you can't tell which slit it goes through. So it does interact. And I believe that that is sufficient to collapse the wave function, which basically then explains this. However, if you start looking at lots of things, what you'll find is that people have gotten very excited about the fact that you're not destroying the electron, but you are gaining knowledge about which slit the electron goes through. And so people get a bit carried away thinking that that it is because they argue you haven't destroyed the electron, so in a sense you shouldn't have affected the wave function. Since the electron hasn't interacted, the wave function shouldn't have collapsed, but you have gained knowledge of where that electron is. And it is in the gaining of the knowledge that somehow it's the interaction with the observer that collapses the wave function. So you may run into that, and I'll talk about a pretty a very recent modern sort of examples of this. But there's a lot of discussion about the observer and maybe consciousness becoming a part of collapsing the wave function. Okay? So just a little bit of a preview. But this is pretty bizarre, actually, that this really does happen. But to me, I believe the answer is, or the way in which I think of it, is that, in fact, you cannot put a non-destructive detector there that actually can give you information about which slit it went through without somehow interacting with that wave function. And when you do, you will cause it to collapse. And this is something that, in the more modern terminology, we call decoherence, where you can take some sort of entangled state. This particular state isn't, I don't know that we'd call it an entangled state, but you can take a quantum state that has multiple possibilities and make it collapse. It would be sort of decoherence. Okay, so we've talked a bit about Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics and how it leads to some of this very strange collapse instantaneously possible interactions with the observer. It's sort of a weird world to think about. And so let's go to a third example. And this is sort of the same thing we've been talking about, but this again is an example that's so absurd that it causes people to sort of sit up and realize how strange some of this stuff really is. So this is an example you've, again, probably heard of. It's called Schrodinger's cat. And in this example, you take a cat and you stuff your cat in a box. And in the box, you have a radioactive nucleus. And let's just say that this radioactive nucleus, we know, has a probability of 50% to decay within an hour. All right? And you then put a little radiation detector, and if this nucleus decays, you'll get a signal in the radiation detector, which then puts a signal over here, and a hammer drops on a vial of poison and kills the cat. Okay? So this really is sort of this fabricated example that says you've got a quantum mechanical process that has a 50-50 probability of happening within the next hour. And how do we look at this system? When you now close the lid of the box, what is the state of the cat? All we know from the point of view of quantum mechanics is about the probability, and what we know is that 1 hour later, if we open the lid of the box, there's a 50% chance the cat's dead. And that you can observe. But in quantum mechanics, you now have to ask, well, what is the state of the cat when the lid is closed? And quite literally, you would describe the state of this cat in quantum mechanics as basically being half dead and half alive. Because the wave function of the cat has to carry within it all the possibilities. Which is pretty weird. This is a viable quantum mechanical state. It is the thing that psi is. Okay. And then the minute you open the lid of the box, the wave function collapses into one state or the other. So, this is a very strange business. And we talked a little bit last time. I think I've given you reading on Hugh Everett a bit. It's actually an interesting story. Young physicist Hugh Everett, for one of his first projects, forget if it was his thesis, it may have been his thesis, developed a theory of quantum mechanics which he said, well, the problem with this is you're too limited in your view of the wave function, so allow the wave function to encompass everything, and you basically let both threads of this reality carry through. So the wave function itself contains both of these possibilities. And so one way of viewing it would be as if the moment you close the box, the universe splits into two, and in one universe, the cat's alive, and in the other universe, the cat's dead. And you now don't have to carry this nonsense of having a wave function that has a half-dead, half-alive thing. You don't have to worry about instantaneous collapse of anything, because the wave function never collapses, it just evolves in time, or both threads are apart. And this, Bryce DeWitt coined the term many worlds interpretation long after he came up with it. When Hugh Everett wrote it, it was called the relative, and I forgot what it's called, it's in the number of the relative states formulation, something like that. Bohr didn't like this. And at some level, Bohr was a very influential guy around this time. And more or less, they killed this guy's career. He didn't have a happy life. This part, one of the articles I've asked you to read talks about it. It's fairly interesting. But as the years have gone by, this is actually a very elegant formulation of quantum mechanics. And it doesn't contain some of these other problems. You can't actually tell, sort of by design, you can't tell the difference between the Copenhagen stuff and this many worlds interpretation in the lab. I don't think you can actually literally distinguish between the two different concepts. But this is one where all of these, what it basically is saying is that we live in a multiverse in in the space that quantum mechanics uses. So let me talk a minute about that.
So when we do a quantum mechanical calculation, when we talk about space, you're used to us thinking about three-dimensional space, x, y, z, a time. And certainly that can work. If I'm really trying to describe a system, it's actually much more complex than that. A particle could have an x, y, z. It can have a momentum in the x, and momentum in the y, momentum in the z. There could be multiple particles. So I could have two particles, and I could have an x, y, z, and momentum for this particle. And this particle could be completely independent of anything else. So it turns out when you do your calculation, you would actually have a dimensionality in your mathematical theory of x, y, z for this particle plus x, y, z of that particle. That's six dimensions right there. If I have three particles, just the spatial stuff gives you nine dimensions, etc. So it turns out that, and then if you start adding other degrees of freedom, like spins and how they interact, and etc., it gets ridiculously complex. So it turns out that this infinite dimensional space in which we do these kinds of calculations is called Hilbert space for quantum mechanics. And I'll never forget when my quantum mechanics professor in graduate school starts coming in and starts talking about Hilbert space. I was like, what are you talking about? And in fact, I'm pretty sure I graduated from graduate school without having any idea what he's talking about. Fortunately, you don't really have to understand Hilbert space to do basic calculations in quantum mechanics. But conceptually, the way to think about it is that it's sort of like we live in this infinite dimensional reality, and you're describing parts of it with the way these things interact. So what does that mean? It's a way of trying to explain why it is that we're not aware of all of these other threads of reality, if indeed a quantum mechanics process that may have a 50-50 probability can happen, and there's a thread in Hilbert space where it happens one way and a thread in Hilbert space where it happens in the other way. We're either in a thread where a cat's alive or we're in a thread where the cat is dead and there's nowhere in between. And if we're in the one where the cat is alive, that cat was always alive to us when we look back at the history of it. So it's as if these threads really are quite separate. And that's sort of how I would call them, multiple universes or multiple realities. It certainly fits the definition of the universe that we started with at the start of the course, in the sense that each one encompasses all you can possibly know, and yet they may be quite separate. So how can this make any sense to us? Well, let's take a simpler case. Let us imagine that we have two worms. And the worms basically live in this two-dimensional reality of the floor. And let's say these worms happen to be in a grocery store. We could have worms that live in their two-dimensional reality that they observe at the same position, literally, in terms of its x and y on the floor, for example. We can have two worms and have them on shelves that are separated in z, or separated in that third dimension. But the worms don't really perceive that third dimension, so they have no idea they're there, and yet they're exactly the same position in their reality. Okay? So in this Hilbert space idea, basically, you can have these threads occupy the same reality, but they're separated in the overall Hilbert space by this one dimension of that quantum mechanical effect, whatever it was. And when they are, unless you could step out into a reality where you could see that extra dimension, you're not aware of the other. So that's sort of the picture. To elaborate on this a bit more,
if you take this to an extreme, you can sort of think, okay, I have a quantum mechanical event, I get two universes. Now in this universe I have a quantum mechanical event, and that universe I have a quantum mechanical event, they do different. So I get two more. And I get two more, and I get two more. So you very quickly get an infinite number of universes. But it's really vastly worse than that, because most quantum processes have far more than two possibilities. And I mean, just like this electron is diffracted through a slit, it's not like that electron goes here or there. There is a continuum of possibilities for that electron. So basically, just that one process would give you an infinite number of possibilities. Worse than that, if you imagine that I have this quantum mechanical process happening now with a 50-50 probability, at the instant it happens, everything else in the universe is the same in both of these universes. So basically, they're just the same. You're sitting over there, you have no idea that this thing, this particle, is decayed. The universe looks the same to you. And now, somewhere over in Alpha Centauri, some other particle decays. We aren't really aware of it, but within the Hilbert space, we've now sort of bifurcated into yet another universe. So a way to think about this is that we live in sort of a continuum of universes in the many worlds idea, each of which differs very little from the other. So there's an analogy, which I think I tried to pull off. I read it in a nice paper, and I think I tried to pull it off in my book, where if I were to take a bunch of sheets of paper and dribble ink on them, and then pull them together into a book, so the ink bleeds in a few sheets as I pull this thing together, then what you would see is that as I look at each adjoining sheet, the pattern would be very similar. It would be minute differences. But if I went 20 sheets, I'd begin to see a pattern that's really quite different. But it'd be like a continuum where the differences are almost unobservable from one thing to another. But as I go from the front of the book to the back of the book, I would see two very distinctly different ink patterns. But the change would be almost continuous as you went through. So that might be a better way to sort of try to imagine what's going on with the multiple universes in the many worlds theory. Can I get my head around that? Not easily. I'm not comfortable with it. I think mathematically it is much more elegant in the sense that when I was in graduate school, when I was in graduate school, I think there was some mention of this, that that's all there was. We learned how to calculate using Schrodinger's equation and basically the Copenhagen interpretation. And I think most physicists just sort of get comfortable with that idea and sort of shrug and go, well, I don't know everything about this wave function, so I don't worry about it. And people sort of call that attitude the shut up and calculate attitude. And it does work, actually. I mean, you can calculate things, but you don't worry too much about what's underneath. I don't know if the tide is really shifting, but I will say that as I learned more about this, as I was thinking about this subject, developing an understanding enough to write this book, I became much happier with this whole multiple universe idea in terms of its mathematical elements. I actually do think that Everett's formulation of quantum mechanics is far more elegant and interesting than this idea of a collapsing wave function. But it really does present some really strange problems, because you have this continuum of different realities all of a sudden. So I don't know what you do with that. It's very strange. Now, one of the interesting things I ran into when I finished writing this book was that I had to do a lot of radio interviews. And by far and away, the vast majority of the radio interviews that I did for this book were with paranormal blog radio stations. And at first, that scared the crap out of me, because I'm a serious scientist and I don't want to ruin my reputation. And then I thought, well, why in the world did I write this to you in the first place? Well, part of it is education, right? So I thought, okay, fine, I'll talk to these people. And it turns out they were all very nice, and you know, they were good. But the other thing that really puzzled me at first, when I started just getting invitation after invitation to the paranormal blog radio station, I'm like, why? This is a science book, actually. Why are you guys calling me? And by about the fifth interview, I figured it out, because almost to a person, they always ask, so do you think ghosts are just shadows from other dimensions? And in a funny way, what they're sort of saying is you have a person in many worlds, and somehow you're seeing evidence of them in your world, that maybe that's what a ghost is. Or are UFOs flitting in and out from other dimensions? These are the things that kept asking. So there's a lot of confusion about many worlds and everything. They never liked my answer, which was many worlds works because when you have this different thread of reality, it doesn't communicate anymore. It's a different dimensionality, so you don't communicate. So in that sense, it works as a multiple universe. But the problem with multiple universes is, by definition, you can't communicate with the other universe. Because if you did, it'd be part of your universe. So if a ghost was flitting in from some other part of Hilbert space, then we really couldn't consider it a multiple universe, but it'd be very strange. Well, it'd be totally fabulous. So, you guys have any thoughts? Heard about any of this stuff? Any questions? Yeah.
So, you're saying like, before you actually like perceive the particle interacting with the film, you have no idea where it is. Does that mean it could be like in another universe, technically?
No, in that thinking, I'm thinking of it as in our universe, but if the probability distribution allows it to be, you know, 100 miles away, then it, in principle, could. There is a non-zero probability that it actually ends up interacting with it. That's a bit extreme, because physically, but physically, if I send light through a single slit, it can split, and you've seen it can split into something sort of wide. And so the photon could be, in principle, anywhere along there. And you can concoct an example where that is much, much wider. And so in that picture, it is in our universe until the moment that it interacts. At the moment it interacts, okay, so in the Copenhagen interpretation, it all stays in our universe. You have this wave function that allows it to potentially interact anywhere along here, and the moment it does, the wave function collapses instantaneously, and that's where it is. But it all happens in our universe. There's no other thread of reality. There's only one thread of reality in Hilbert space. Okay? The other picture says that the photon goes through the slit. And I guess at the moment it goes through the two slits, the universe basically splits in Hilbert space into an infinite number of possibilities, where each possibility corresponds to a different spot where that photon interacts on the screen. And if we happen to be in, you know, thread number 3,474, it interacts right here. 3,475, it's interacting right there. Everything else in the universe stays the same, but within Hilbert space of possibilities, that's the one thing that's changed.
Just, would that mean that for all of those possible, all those possible universes also exist in some other space? Or?
That's the idea, yeah. So if you carry this many worlds thing to an extreme, there is no preference for any one of them. There are more of them where it interacted toward the center than toward the outside. That's what you mean by probability distribution. But you would only be sensitive to that whole probability distribution if you were able to step outside of helper space and somehow see all these different threads. Because for every process, all of the possibilities happen. This is one of the examples where basically people say anything that could happen has happened. It's just you're only sensitive to this one thread. Weird. Yeah.
How would you? So, like, when you guys talk about like instantaneous, change, like the wave function collapsing instantaneously. Like, what's an example of like how do you use like a detector that is like farther than the particle could travel, if where that information could travel at the speed of light? Like, why does it violate? Or like, what is an example of an experiment that like shows that it violates the speed of light?
Oh yeah, okay. So the EPR paradox is Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen thing. Okay, this particle can decay, decays into two photons that then move out. These photons either have their spins correlated like this or like that. In that picture, they share the same wave function, the correlate, and they are now propagating outward at the speed of light, okay? This one can go thousands of miles, and that one can go thousands of miles. 1,000 miles away, I have a detector where I see that photon. In the picture of quantum mechanics, that wave function collapses instantaneously. I can detect that one, and it means this one is determined. And I can set up something so that I can detect this one and I can detect that one before light would have the time to travel all this way. And I will find them and put it forward.
So that is sort of the basis of entanglement?
The correlation, yeah, I mean, that's what entanglement means, is that you have these correlated probabilities.
So they both become particles, which are both detected?
They're both particles, but the idea is if I detect the state of one of them, I have determined the other instantaneously. It's not like I detect this one, pick up the phone, call the person over there and tell them, you know, your photon needs to be whatever. If they detect it, it is what it is, and it's always going to correlate with what this one is, it's an entangled state. And that information, it's not information, it's somehow that's, it's somehow done instantaneously. So the moment this one is entangled, that one is
This is kind of sort of like, if you were traveling at the speed of light, would you not be able to determine where you end up? Would that just be a probability? Using this analogy. Like, would you be, in a sense, a wave function if you're traveling at the speed of light? And then someone else would have to observe you for your wave function to collapse.
If you were traveling the speed of light, your wave, particles that travel faster and faster, the Broglie wavelength, the Broglie wavelength is HRP, so if P is gets big, the Broglie wavelength actually gets smaller, so your wave function becomes sharper to the extent that it's not already sharp. I'm just going to have to plead. I don't really know how to answer that, so I don't know. Okay, so there's one type of multiverse. Let me ask, how many of you have ever read or heard of the book called The Secret? So the author of this book's name is Noam Chomsky. And when I was working on this book, I was talking to a friend of mine, and she's like, I've been reading about quantum physics. I'm like, okay. She says, yeah, I've been reading The Secret. I'm like, I'm like, no, quantum physics. And she says,
it's pretty wild what you guys are doing.
And so she started telling me a little bit about how quantum physics was telling her how she was going to make $1 million or whatever it was she wanted at the time. And so I started looking at it, and it was really at the time that I was starting to write this book and think about what distinguished, what really you meant when you talk about a multiple universe scenario. I mean, what's a universe? And it got quite interesting. So I went and I grabbed the book. It's called The Secret. There's a movie that's out that talks about a lot of the same sorts of things, which is called What the Bleep Do We Know? And I think probably I will ask you guys to look at this, because it's sort of fun. Anyway, so what The Secret tells you is that if you really, really, really want something, and you really believe that it's possible, you'll get it. And you have to do four things. You have to know exactly what it is that you want. You have to ask the universe for it. You have to feel, behave, and know as if the object of your desire is already yours, and be open to receive it, and let go of the outcome, forgotten about that. But basically, these are the four rules. So the sense of it is, you know, if you want something badly enough and you believe in it, the universe will basically give it to you. And they actually quote physicists for the proof of this. And I was just trying to understand what their logic was in all of this. And as near as I can tell, the logic really is sort of as follows. I mentioned the fact that it is the observation in the double-slit experiment that collapses the wave function if you put this non-destructive detector. I mean, at least that's part of the perception. The non-destructive detector actually messes with the wave function a little bit, which causes this collapse, and I think that's what's happening. But there is a school of thought that says it's the observation of that wave function, that is, it is the human consciousness that is causing the wave function to collapse. So there is, you will hear and read about, things where human consciousness is entwined in the wave function of the universe and causes the universe to collapse. And that's basically what's going on here. They're really saying that consciousness is entwined with the wave function of the universe, and there are all of these different possibilities, and your consciousness is causing the wave function to collapse on the thread that gives you what you want. That's, I think, the essence of it. It's not the science conceptual part of it isn't said very clearly in either of these pieces, but as near as I can tell, that's sort of what it is. Do you see anything wrong with that? I have a couple of complaints. One is they actually are mixing up the two different conceptual pictures. You have the one picture of a collapsing wave function. You have another picture of a large reality with all the different threads involved. But you can't say that my mind is going to pick what thread I'm in, and I'm going to collapse around it, because that's sort of conceptually mixing up Copenhagen with many worlds in some weird sort of way. So I think that actually just simply doesn't work conceptually. Scientifically, you can pick on some other aspects of this. people have measured the time over which quantum processes actually happen. And, for example, chemical processes and things like that, the time over which you have sort of the fuzzy state before it collapses, if you want to think of it in a Copenhagen way, is very short. I mean, you're talking 10 minus 23 seconds or something like that, very short. And actually, there are ways, when we get to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, there are ways to correlate things that you measure in terms of energy or mass with time, which I'm not going to talk about right now, but there are ways to actually measure this sort of coherence time in the lab. So what that means is that the universe does quantum things on a very fast time scale, and vastly faster than you can have a conscious thought. So it's a little bit hard to imagine that you can affect any sort of quantum process in the universe by actually thinking about it. The other issue is, so if you believe that conscious thought is a product of the chemical processes in your brain, there's also an inherent time frame over which that kind of thing happens. And electric currents and the movement of different atoms and things like that through membranes all happen to a finite speed. So you're inherently sort of limited if you believe that conscious thought and whatever you might think of it as a wave function somehow is responsible for affecting quantum processes in the universe. So I think one way around this is to say that conscious thought is independent of the chemical matter reality that we think of as the brain. But the minute that you say that, I think you're outside the realm of science. Because I don't know what reality you're talking about. That to me is almost a religious statement. Well, it is a religious statement. You can believe it. But so the moment you say that, I don't know what to make for coherence times or how it might connect with the universe. Okay? But if you're in scientific reality, we think we understand how the brain operates. And if you say that thought and everything is associated with the movement of chemicals and substances across membranes and electric processes, those we actually measure. We know they happen with finite speeds, etc. So I don't see how that happens. So one can argue it's actually pretty amusing. I think we'll look at the book, and I know I pick on this a little bit at some point in Visions. If you go and poke on the websites of some of these physics labs, it's pretty interesting. I mean, they use some words, but most of what they say is sort of nonsense. There's one guy that I do pick on in my book, I'm pretty sure, talks about doing quantum activism. And so what he's saying is, because your brain is so connected with the universe, you should think about doing good things. And we're all making the universe do good things. So he's a proponent for what he calls quantum activism. So it's pretty fun stuff. At any rate, I've included it in Visions as a version of a multiverse, because in a sense it sort of is. This is if you allow for the non-scientific basis, multiverse is this sort of one of them, and I wanted to talk a little bit about this. And in that book, I call it the multiverse of wishful thinking. And you think you want this, and somehow it collapses the wave function. I mean, it has some association with many worlds and some association with Copenhagen, and I can't quite untangle it all. And I'm not sure anybody really knows how, but they have figured out how to make a lot of money. Now, what I'd like to do is to not confuse this for the fact that I think the mental state of somebody is very important. if you've ever played sports, momentum in sport is a very good thing. If you're confident, you know, it really can help you pull something off. If you, I think mental state is very important health-wise. You know, there are lots of studies that sort of show this. So I don't think that, I'm sure that your mental state has a lot to do with your reality, okay, in that sense. I just don't think it happens this way. And I think that there are real biological effects that happen with confidence and with believing in yourself and having a positive attitude in life, and et cetera. That is important. I don't think it's quantum mechanics. Yeah.
My question is, when did this idea of like the wave function of the universe come about? Is that from the same sort of Einstein?
The large-scale wave function of the universe and how individual processes are being just a piece of that evolving, that was 1957 by this guy, Everett. Hugh Everett, yeah.
So I think that's really interesting, because like, this all sort of ties in with I'm in a modern fiction class, and I'm reading The Waves, or I've read The Waves by Virginia Woolf, and she very much like sort of talks about the universe in this sort of fashion. I was wondering exactly, I'm trying to figure out what exactly has influenced her sort of views on this.
So, when was that book?
In 1931.
Interesting.
Yeah, but she talks about, like, she uses like a lot of like imagery involving waves and sort of compares. Like it follows like the lives of like six individuals, and sort of like it goes from like viewing them as like individuals, like a part of the wave, to viewing them as like part of the wave existence, essentially.
Yeah.
And like even like imagery within the book, like goes from comparing like people on the streets as like individuals all walking on the street, to comparing them to being like, or calling them like a crowd. Like, which is like making them a collective, and like referring, like, and then sort of comparing that with like a stream. Like a stream, you think of it as like an individual unit, but like you also view it as a bunch of particles.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't know. 1931, she could conceivably have been influenced a little bit by the development of quantum mechanics, which was starting. So the whole idea of waves was probably not in physics at that time. The idea of the universe all being very connected is something that's been with us always.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that helped whoever drive his ideas or not. I don't remember. I'd have to reread that article. I mean, it's a pretty nice article on Hugh from Physics Today, I think it is, that kind of sounded that it says something like that. That's interesting. All right, I think we're out of time for today. Have a good weekend. Have a good spring break. And I'll try to do my homework for you guys in the next couple of days. If you're lucky enough to be contemplating some waves at the beach,
have a glass of wine and think of me.